Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Steve's Left and Kathy Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Smashing.
You know, I was going through some local sections of the New York Times. The New York Times publishes in the suburbs around it. There are four local sections. There's Long Island, New Jersey, something.
Yeah, well, now the New Jersey section, it's kind of a all together.
But the restaurant reviews are for the individual areas.
Correct.
So, but there was an article called Old Friends, Last Meals, Sad Dances about a restaurant called Marsilio's. Now, for those of you in New Jersey who are listening to us on terrestrial radio, you've probably heard of Marsilio's in Trenton. It was a fixture of old Chambersburg.
Mm-hmm. Chambersburg is a neighborhood in Trenton.
Traditionally an Italian,
which was an Italian neighborhood, and it was known as it had this huge restaurant row. And if you wanted kind of that Nona's classical Italian food, and you were in New Jersey, frankly, certainly down in Central Jersey, that was where you went. It was this enclave of restaurants, all kind of stacked together, where one restaurant kind of fed on the other, and the neighborhood was where you went, and then you chose which restaurant you were going to go to.
It was a neighborhood where you were more likely to hear Italian spoken than not, you know, which I always find amusing when I hear people talk about how they get offended to hear Spanish spoken in their neighborhoods. And I'm like, but remember Little Italy?
Yeah.
Remember that?
It was, honestly, it was more Little Italy than most of the Little Italies in a lot of the cities across America.
Oh, yeah, because it was working class or working class families, and there was the church and there were the restaurants. And Lorenzo's was a big steakhouse down in Trenton. And Marsilio's is you know, the last of a breed of restaurants. There were, I think, over 100 restaurants down there.
And it was one of those political places that you could see all the politicos hanging out, one of those haunts.
Sure, and Democrats, Republicans, who was in power, who was out of power. But like a lot of places, as the demographics have changed, you know, people have moved. And those restaurants relied upon
the locals.
A community of locals who would go and eat that food. And yes, they were there for people to come in from out of town. And for a long time, what's left of Chambersburg as an Italian enclave was people coming in from out of town to go to these Italian restaurants. But it's not an Italian neighborhood anymore.
Right.
You know, and
that's what I was just about to say. You counted on those people to work in the restaurants as well as be the customers of those restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And as the neighborhood changed, as the neighborhood developed, because that's what it's done. It's gone to the next stage of being a neighborhood.
That's a charitable way of putting it. I mean, let's be clear. Look, the cities in New Jersey, some of them are doing extremely well, like New Brunswick, and some of them are facing some tough challenges and trying their best to do as good as they can. And Trenton is facing some tough challenges.
Definitely one of those tough challenge cities right now.
It's not like Chambersburg has gone on to the next redevelopment, and now there's
lots bigger and better.
Sky high rises there or whatever. You know, it's a challenged area, and it's more challenged now than it was in 1940, that's for sure.
So what's happened in Chambersburg is these restaurants are slowly closing.
They're almost gone.
And there are almost none of them left, and Marsilio's was one of the very last of these restaurants. And there are still a few left there, but the really big ones, the big name restaurants that people might recognize, certainly if you're from Central Jersey, Diamonds, Marsilio's, places like that, are just gone.
You know, I think what's interesting is for many cultures, the restaurants, especially for food cultures, the restaurants really, they play an important role in establishing a community, and they really can have some pretty serious roots depending on the culture. So I come from Orange, New Jersey. My dad was the Orange fire chief. Libretti's is a restaurant that may still be there, and I think some people still go there in the Valley in Orange, which was an Irish and Italian neighborhood. And there were a lot of Italian restaurants, vibrant Italian restaurants in Orange. And Orange is a really troubled city right now, and they're trying to hold on. And it's funny, the restaurants stay there longer because even when the people move out, they go back. There's a restaurant in Orange, New Jersey called the Star Tavern.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recommend it highly enough. If you grew up anywhere near the Oranges or in Essex County,
it's a great place.
You grew up on Star Tavern. It doesn't travel well. Got to have it there. But the Star Tavern is in a really difficult neighborhood. When I went to the Star Tavern as a kid, it was in the middle of a friendly, you know, low crime neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's there's a police cruiser. They pay for an orange police cruiser to sit out front of the Star Tavern in the parking lot with the light on
every night, all the time,
with an armed policeman in there. So nothing bad happens to you at the Star Tavern, but that neighborhood is gone except for the Star Tavern.
Mm-hmm. And well, it's a last little enclave inside. Of that last little vestige of what was the old neighborhood that kind of refuses to go away. And what Francis was talking about earlier is you'll do that. You'll go to that old place in that old city that you lived in that you left for let's call it bigger and better because, you know, that's what people are leaving for.
Yeah.
That you left for bigger and better, but that restaurant still can pull you back for 3 hours, for 4 hours.
And that restaurant can pull the next generations back. My mm-hmm. niece never was in Orange, never knew an Orange that she would walk down Main Street in. Yet we go to the Star Tavern, and my nephews and nieces go to the Star Tavern with us. And it just speaks to how important a restaurant can be as a pillar of a community. I look at... it can be the last, you know, the last support standing when the rest of it's all washed away. And it's also one of the first things to establish.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. It can be one of the last things standing, but it also can be one of the first things standing, or even one of those things that turns a city around. You know, New Brunswick, we talk about New Brunswick all the time. Frog and the Peach was in a very, very challenged neighborhood when it first opened.
And then when we opened, we pushed that neighborhood. We went. They sort of helped reclaim a certain area, and we went to the very edge of that area. But on the other token, we're talking about expensive, nice restaurants to bring back a certain caliber of people to walk in the town and make it safer and get a little traffic going.
But even neighborhood restaurants.
I'm going to say, there's a very strong Mexican community in New Brunswick. Look at the Mexican restaurants. You want some really good, authentic Mexican food? You know, you go up French Street or you go into some of the other Mexican neighborhoods, there's really great Mexican and a few other Latin American restaurants.
And what does that do? It takes people... Now, I'm not talking about nightclubs and I'm not talking about places that are bar, just a bar scene and hangouts that way. What I'm talking about are restaurants and restaurant bars and places where people get together to have a good time but not necessarily a raucous time.
Right.
And what does that do? It puts adults out on the street later at night, and when you put a lot of people, a lot of adults out later at night, by definition, the neighborhood becomes safer because there's just more and more people who are looking to have a good time without having a destructive time out on the street.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that when I saw that Marsilio's was closing, I thought it was very sad.
It is sad.
And I do think it's sad, but it reminded me of how important those restaurants were to the identity of Chambersburg, and how, look, everybody's gone, and Marsilio's got to shut out the light when they leave. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that neighborhood's done for. I'm just saying it needs a lot of work. But as far as the Italian-American community of Chambersburg, you know, they all left a long time ago, and Marsilio's held out and stayed there and stayed a part of the community, and restaurants have a really great social utility that way. So go to your local restaurant that's owned by a guy, not by a corporation, and have something to eat and tell him you think he's important. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with Chris Cosentino. Chris is the chef of Encanto Restaurant in California. He's a renowned San Francisco area chef. He's cooked across the country. And most recently, he was a contestant on The Next Iron Chef.
Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, man, now we should remind our audience, we've had a number of folks on from The Next Iron Chef. We should remind our audience that The Next Iron Chef is not Top Chef. These are not like young aspirants. These are established chefs from across the country competing to become the next standard Iron Chef with Kat Cora and the stable of standard Iron Chefs. Now, what prompted you, Chris? I mean, you're an established chef. You have a lot of press. People know who you are. Your restaurants are busy. You run restaurants every day. What prompted you to go on a reality show as long and grueling as this?
Well, I really didn't look at it as a reality show. Mm-hmm. For me, I looked at it as the opportunity to compete against some absolutely exceptional chefs from around the country. We don't really get to compete in this business. We compete for business, meaning trying to get customers in the door. But I think the ultimate goal to be that, be an Iron Chef. You know, I used to go and watch the Japanese version of Iron Chef before it was subtitled into English. And I used to go to a bar and nobody spoke English except for the bartender. And I would go with a bunch of cooks and drink beer and get really rowdy watching the show. And so I wanted to be on the show and compete first. And then I had that opportunity to battle against Mario last season. I did battle Garlic. Lost by 2 points.
Mm. I was going to say, battle Garlic against Mario is a tough
it was close.
Tough hill to climb.
It's a tough hill to climb, but it was really close.
That's great.
And then when this opportunity came, I just couldn't say no.
Mm.
You know, it's a great, great opportunity. And to be an Iron Chef, you have the ability to compete against some of the best culinary minds in the United States.
You know, I found it interesting that some of you guys really knew each other very well and that you worked for some of the people who you competed against and with some of the people you competed against.
Actually, two of the other chefs were my former employers.
Hmm.
So Tracy Desjardins was my chef and boss at Rubicon when I first moved to San Francisco. And Maru Watara was my first boss, direct chef boss in a fine dining restaurant.
Was that intimidating at all for you?
You know, it wasn't intimidating as much as uncomfortable. you know, but what it, for me, I think what it was that it showed how much time and effort they put into me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they spent the time. Maru was the first person to really take me seriously, you know, because I was a loudmouth kid.
I'm actually still waiting for someone to take me seriously.
Yeah. So it was very interesting to actually be there with them, and I'm hoping that they, you know, felt that all their hard work into me was worth it.
I have to say, I mean, you cook some pretty special food, and you staked out a pretty serious position for yourselves in a number of ways, and we're going to talk more about that in the show, in our show going forward. But, you know, what I've said to everybody who's been on that show, who's come and talked with us on The Restaurant Guys, is, you know, you are engaged. The real contest you're engaged in, you alluded to it before, is you're in a contest every day. Every day that restaurant opens, every day that people come in, every day that people either decide it's great or decide it's not great and decide to come back or not. But being on a national show in such a prominent way, as the next Iron Chef put you, and that has to have made a change in the restaurant as far as business is concerned, as far as your recognition is concerned. What changes has that brought to you?
There's been a bunch of changes. I mean, I get recognized a lot more, which is sometimes extremely uncomfortable. You know, but business-wise, you definitely see a lot more people pointing into the kitchen, looking. Mm-hmm. You know, they see me in there. But you definitely get more hate mail.
Really?
Oh, yeah, of course you do.
Come on.
You know, well, think about it in this way. You're on television. You've opened yourself up to a larger, you basically become a bigger target.
Well, so what do they write you hate mail about? Your haircut?
Well, no, actually, they feel that I speak inappropriately to people.
How do you mean? Like,
well,
is you rude
for instance, the Lufthansa, the Munich episode, the cameraman was so close to me. Every time I would turn, my elbows would touch a camera guy. I mean, they were so close.
Right. So,
and I was concerned that I was either going to cut myself or I was going to get burned. So I got pretty vocal telling them to get back. And then they wouldn't, and they got closer. So I kept on going and kept on pushing. So.
And then, of course, that became the highlight of the show.
That became the highlight of the show, me getting pretty aggro with them. So I get hate mail saying that I should have never been there. I don't know how to speak to people. I got an email from...
I'm shocked, by the way, because I didn't think...
Because you're mad at
the... I didn't think you came off that badly. I mean, obviously, you were in an intense situation with the camera right on top of you. I guess maybe I understand a little better.
It's a very different... I mean, Munich was a very different situation than being in Stadium Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You have camera guys that have done it 92 episodes. know when to move,
right.
how close to get, because they don't want to impede your ability to do your job.
Right.
And your job is to cook, cook fast, and cook well. In Germany, these were new camera guys.
Who'd never done it before.
They'd never done it before. Didn't speak great English. So, you know, I'm struggling with not only a language barrier, but for the ability to make them understand they need to step back. I'm in a very limited amount of time.
Yeah, plus at the same time, you're under a huge amount of stress trying to put these dishes out.
With knives and fire.
With knives and fire.
Hold on a second. We're going to leave that right there. We'll come back in just a moment talking more with Chris Cosentino, executive chef of Encanto Restaurant in California, and most recently on The Next Iron Chef. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Captain Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're talking with Chris Cosentino, executive chef of Encanto and most recently of The Iron Chef. We were talking, Chris, before the break about you get hate mail because when the inexperienced camera guys in Germany were pushing a little close to you and impeding your ability to cook, you were stern and forced them to get back. I'm surprised at that, first of all, because... I mean, you know, Gordon Ramsay humiliates people every day.
Yeah, I didn't think you handled that in any way other than, listen, you need to stay back, give me a certain amount of distance.
And let me just let's point out a difference here. Gordon Ramsay, you know, what I find in what he does in his show, and I don't know that he does this in his restaurant, but you know, you have someone who's underperforming and you scream at them to completely debilitate them is exactly what you don't want to do as a chef. You know, it doesn't serve a purpose. But if you're in a kitchen, again, there's knives and fire and people working very quickly in a kitchen. A chef needs to be stern sometimes. And if someone's doing something that's dangerous or impeding the workflow and they don't listen the first time, you need to be stern. I thought you handled that completely appropriately.
Well, I guess people feel otherwise. I mean, I even got a letter from somebody from the cameraman's union. So, you know, it is what it is. Everybody has opinions, and everybody feels that they understand the situation and where you're at that moment. But they're not there. They're not a part of it.
What else?
You know, they don't know what the emotion's like. They don't know what the feeling's like. You know, that particular challenge, we had an hour and 30 minutes to produce what was to be, I had to produce for four judges
mm-hmm.
plus Alton.
Right.
So that's times three. Okay, so that's 15 dishes. You give you an hour and a half. Ultimately, you don't have an hour and a half because you have to package it. You have
mm-hmm.
to cover it. You have to transport it. You have to blast chill it. So, you know, that's really about an hour of cooking and a half an hour of packaging.
Right, yeah, which is a couple of minutes of plate.
Yeah.
Just isn't that amount of time.
It's really not that much amount of time, and I think it's just lost. And people don't understand. I don't think they'll ever really understand how hard this show was.
Sometimes people don't understand what actually happens behind the scenes and what we're actually doing in our restaurants with some of the philosophies that we have. And this isn't the only thing that people have sent you mail, we'll call hate mail about. We're going to talk on the other side of the news about some of the things that Chef Chris Cosentino has had people write to him about, and maybe not in the best way.
When we come back after the news, we're going to find out why everybody hates Chris Cosentino so much. stay tuned. We'll be back after the news. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
It's Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Chris Cosentino is the executive chef at Encanto Restaurant in California. He's one of the top chefs in the country. He was most recently a contestant on The Next Iron Chef.
Before the news, we were talking about why everybody hates Chris.
Watch for it on the Bravo Network.
Seriously, we were talking off the air a little bit about you are a specialist in a style of cuisine or a type of meat called offal. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that, the food that you're using, and why you think it's such an important part of cuisine today?
Well, for starters, the word offal is actually a term that has come, it's a Latin term, and it means to off-fall from the carcass. So that means all the innards, which would be stomach, heart, liver, kidney, spleen. As time has gone on, feet, skin, head, and tail have been encompassed into that mix. For me, I look at these cuts of meat as history, and also what people consider waste.
For me, I look at some of these cuts of meat as some of the tastiest parts of the animal.
Well, they are. I mean, they're really, really high in nutrients and vitamins and minerals. And the way I try to explain it to a lot of people, the first-timers at the restaurant who are really squeamish about it, you can take, and I use beef always as an example because most of the people that are squeamish about it always ask why I don't have beef on my menu. We are very comfortable with skeletal meats, which are your T-bones, tenderloins, you know, rump roast, steamship round. But all those cuts, they're all meat. They all have the same texture. They all have the same flavor.
It's all muscle.
It's all muscle, okay? But when you break into the fifth quarter, which is the butcher's term for, you know, four quarters of an animal, fifth quarter being the offal, you basically open up like this giant painter's palette of flavors and textures with the underlying flavor of that animal. So tripe is a very distinct flavor. It's very strong, very pungent. Texturally, it's extremely different from any muscle meat, but you still get that underlying flavor of beef if you're using a beef tripe. And it's the same thing with tongue. I mean, I can say tongue to me is almost like pastrami, you know.
Yes.
Beef heart is my favorite. You know, I love heart meat. It's got so much depth and flavor and has a lot to offer, but people are afraid of them.
Well, you're grossing some people out right now. There's no doubt about it.
But here's the deal. I think that one of the things about cooking with offal, and there's you and there's Fergus Henderson in England, and there are a lot of people who are starting to embrace these meats, and you'll see them sort of sneaking on to a lot of forward-looking chefs.
Let's say re-embrace, though.
Right, of course. But here's the key with that. I mean, if you take a steak or almost any muscle cut and you either can throw it on the grill and cook it up with some salt and pepper on it, or stick it under a pan and slow braise it to break it down and make a roast out of it, and it sort of works. I think that with offal, you need to have the art of a chef. That's where cooking comes in, to make it delicious, to bring out the flavor in it, and you need to manage it. You can't just take the tripe and throw it on the grill.
No. You'd not be happy.
That'd be, well, you and your neighbors would not be happy.
One of the places I thought you really showed off your skill was in the very first contest here. People had to pick kind of unusual things to make dessert out of, and much to everybody's delight who you were competing against, you went right for the tripe.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of I could have been a complete ass and left it for somebody else,
mm-hmm.
which would have tanked somebody.
Right.
But
somebody else.
Yeah, but for me, it just made logical sense. I mean, I felt that working with that, I have the ability to take that and bring it into a dessert.
Now, talk to us about how we take tripe. Let's first describe tripe for us and let everybody know exactly what it is.
Okay.
And then talk to us about how you would take something that most people are sort of reticent to look at as a savory course, and then you took it and made it into a dessert course. That was really impressed me with that one.
Well, you know, there's ruminant and non-ruminant animals, okay? So, for instance, a pig can eat both meat and vegetation. So they have a single stomach, like us, okay? And then you have a ruminant animal, which is a vegetation animal. So cow, lamb, those animals have four-chambered stomachs, okay? So there's the honeycomb tripe, which is in particular what I received for this particular challenge. The honeycomb tripe is known as the nail stomach because that would be the stomach that would catch metal or anything before it could get into the more delicate areas of the cow's stomach. For this particular challenge, we had 90 minutes to produce two desserts, one with a strange object with no sugar or butter. Okay, so in that short time period, we luckily had some pressure cookers. And so I could pressure cook the tripe. It had to be rinsed and then placed in a pressure cooker, and I used some sweet wine. I used all the fruit that I used for the panzanella aspect of it, all the stone fruit, vanilla, some citrus, fresh citrus juice. I used all of that in the pressure cooker with honey.
And for anybody who's never had tripe, it's a very distinctive, very pungent flavor.
Yeah. I mean, you're in the stomach. I mean, you've got a lot of items in there that could be totally foreign to most people. The flavor itself is very strong. And by adding vanilla and adding honey and some of those aromatic fruits, and I also added mint, it really will cut some of those flavors that people are afraid of. But tripe is also can be like a sponge. That's why a lot of times you see it with something like porcini mushrooms in Italy or tomato in Italy. So it has these really strong flavors that combat with its strong flavor. So that's why the vanilla, the mint, the honey, the strong, you know, sweet wine. And then taking it and frying it after it's cooked, you know, who doesn't like fried items? Okay? You put how many times you guys put crispy on your menu and then it blows out the door?
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Crispy fish. Everybody's like, oh, I have two of those.
We have crispy sweetbreads on our menu right now.
They sell like hotcakes.
They do.
They really
well,
do.
They sell like crispy sweetbreads. Anyway, but go ahead.
So, you know, my concept was to take the tripe and turn it into the crouton.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally, panzanella is a tomato bread salad. So I did a fruit panzanella using the stone fruit and then the tripe that was fried as the croutons. And then to make an olive oil zabayon, which is your, traditionally it would be marsala, sugar, and egg yolks whipped over a double boiler. But instead I used olive oil, eggs, honey, and again the same sweet wine that was in with the tripe.
I have to say, when you pull that out of your hat, I was like, holy crap.
All right, he's good. I have to say, when I saw that, I was like, okay, he's good. No doubt about it.
Is this something you had made before, or have you used elements like this in this way before, or was this something that came out of your head at the moment?
Well, I've done stone fruit panzanella for dessert at the restaurant with zabayon. With tripe, no. Every year we have a fifth quarter menu, or we call it El Quinto Cuarto. We do a head-to-tail event once a year where the whole restaurant, it's always served. And it's always five courses, and that's inclusive of dessert. And every year, we've always done a offal dessert. For instance, this past year, we did candied coxcombs, which is the rooster's crest, mm-hmm. with rice pudding and sweet cherries. So you candy the coxcombs, they turn bright red again, like they look on the rooster's head. And so that was, I'm pretty familiar with taking what people don't want to normally find in dessert and turning it into dessert.
You know, yet you look at other cultures where coxcomb is one of the great delicacies of certain cuisines, and here we basically treat it like garbage.
You know, we treat a lot of these cuts like garbage, and that's the problem.
You know what? I want to talk about that. We're going to take a quick break. I want to come back, and I want to talk about how this is actually your Chris's restaurant is the first California restaurant to be certified humane by an organization called Humane Farm Animal Care. And it may seem incongruous to some of you out there that Chris is so into the nasty bits, as the British call some of this. I've heard it referred to. Yet we're talking at the same time about how this is closely tied with Humane Farm practices, and we'll be back in just a and we'll talk more about some of that hate mail, which I think we're going to be generating for Chris
and for us
in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Chris Cosentino, most recently of the Next Iron Chef and also chef of Encanto Restaurant in California. You can find out more about Chris and Encanto Restaurant by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you up with everything you need to know.
Chris, we've been talking about the offal, the fifth quarter, as you call it, or the butchers call it. Why do you think that we have embraced liver in our culture, both beef liver, goose, duck, and somehow that's okay, but the kidneys, the heart, some of the tripe, other cuts have not been as well received?
No, that's a good question, because we accept foie gras, we accept chicken livers, we accept calf's liver, and sweetbreads. But when you start branching into these other things, I think kidneys, of course, people automatically have assumption or association with urine. Brains, all people can think about it, and whenever we serve brains, I hear people do the zombie thing, you know, from the movie. There's just a complete, they want to just disassociate themselves with it. I think it has a lot to do with a thought of poverty, mm-hmm. which is really odd, because there are dishes in Italy, for instance, there's one called a finanziera, which translates to the financiers. And they would save the specific bits of the coxcomb, the tongue, the testicles, the liver, all the bits from chickens, and serve it just to the wealthy merchants. Mm-hmm.
There was a dish that I had as a kid. One of the very, very first times I had brain was a dish, a French dish that my grandmother made called bouche à la reine, a mouthful for a queen.
Yeah. But see, the people now, it's flipped. Originally, it was save these minimal, there's only one per animal, prized cut for the, you know, for the best, for the wealthy. You know, we went for, it kind of switched. It started as give that stuff to the poor first, and then it switched and went to the wealthy, and then it switched back. Well, so it's just a bizarre process, I think, trying to educate people about it. You know, it's a learning curve, not only for them, but for me. How do I educate them? How do I do it in an appropriate way where they're not going to freak out?
Well, let's talk about for a moment liver and all these. For some reason, I find that when people are cooking and trying to get people to broaden their horizons on what it is to eat from an animal, to me it says, okay, listen, if you're going to kill an animal, to respect that animal, we need to find a way to utilize the whole animal. They say, you know, in modern agribusiness, cows, we take a cow and we throw 55% of that cow into a landfill or grind it up into something and use it.
Yeah, usually they grind it up and feed it back to them.
Right, well, that's...
When we
yeah.
created BSE.
Right, that's yeah, a whole... That's a whole
that's
separate.
Like two more shows
right, exactly.
to talk about mad cow.
But just
briefly, I just have to dive into this for 1 second. One of the things Chris was talking to earlier is there are certain animals that are meant to be omnivores, like we are, and have stomachs and digestive systems that work that way, and certain animals that are meant to eat only vegetation. Cows are one of those animals that are only meant to eat vegetation.
Oh, and wait a minute. We've been feeding them back to themselves with bone meal and blood.
Carnivore, bad idea.
Yeah, bad idea.
Not a good concept.
Bad
yeah.
idea for your cow. But here's the funny thing. We talk about, we've had Adele Douglas, who's the founder of Humane Farm Animal Care. She certified your restaurant to be the first certified humane restaurant in California. We're in for the pro foie gras camp over here ourselves. We believe there is a humane way to raise animals, and there are cruel and torturous ways that mostly corporate agribusiness uses to raise animals. Yet when we talk about these things, it's animal rights activists that attack us, that attack people that often, I'm not saying that all, I consider myself an animal rights activist, mm-hmm. but it strikes me that people who think we shouldn't use animals for food at all come after, rather than going after Kentucky Fried Chicken for how their chickens are raised, and
exactly.
believe you me, they're raised in it. If I got to come back in my next life as a chicken, I'd rather come back as a foie gras duck than a Kentucky Fried Chicken. What do you get the hate mail from the animal rights?
You know, there's no really name or face when it comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is I think for me, when I first started buying all my cuts of offal, I was getting them through Pray the Ranch Meat Company.
Mm-hmm.
It's lamb. They do lamb, pig, and beef. And I would get all my products from them. They're certified humane for all those animals. And I was buying what everybody didn't want. So it was kind of a win-win situation
mm-hmm. right.
for them as the company and the ranchers, and for me because I was getting the cuts that I want.
You got one more win. The customer also gets a win there.
Exactly. Because they're getting a really, really high-quality product. I mean, I don't serve offal in my restaurant unless I know where it's coming from.
Right.
So I don't buy, like, big bulk loads of stuff from agribusiness.
Right.
I think what was amazing to me was the flavor difference between those and I actually tasted them both next to each other, and you know it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It just, until someone actually slaughters an animal, they don't realize how much gets disposed of.
Well, and the reality is, by eating these cuts of meat and encouraging a market for these cuts of meat, look, if you have a meat eater, and as meat eaters, we throw away 20% more of the animal than we need to.
Yeah,
that means we need to kill more animals. Right.
Well, that it boils down to, everybody talks about how we're there's not going to be enough food in the future. Well, it's all about getting over our food aversions.
You know, and the other thing, the most extreme example that I can think of is, you know, there's in Asian countries there's a demand, especially in Japan, for shark fin soup, and because the shark fin is so prized, one of the most wasteful practices for getting food in the world is. People who go looking for shark fins, there are boats that take the sharks on board, cut the fins off because the shark isn't worth that much, and then throw the sharks back to die because they die without their fins. This is an example of what we do when we throw away 55% of an animal that we really only need to throw away 20% of.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you do, and I congratulate you on it. Hey,
thank
Chris,
you.
I'm afraid we need to leave it there, but it's been great to talk to you on the show. I can't wait to come out. Next time I'm out in California, I've got to come to Encanto.
Please, I look forward to it.
Thanks, and, Chris. It's great to have you on the show.
If I come, though, do I have to have tripe for dessert, or can I just have some ice cream?
You can have whatever you want.
It's a deal. If you want to find out more about Chris Cosentino, you can find out about him through our website. You can also find out about Humane Farm Animal Care and Encanto at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Kathleen Lombardi. You know, I love having these guys on from Iron Chef, and I'll tell you why I like having them on. It was interesting to see all these great chefs compete to join the Iron Chef team with Kat Cora, Mario Batali, mm-hmm. and all those guys.
Morimoto.
But what I like about the way we're doing these interviews is we spend a short period of time talking about the show, but these guys are all really interesting people who are hopefully...
They got on the show for a reason. They got on the show because they have a point of view, they have a frame of reference, and they're accomplished at their jobs. And in the show, you spend such a small amount of time with each person that I don't think you get to know them as well as you might otherwise, and hopefully an hour talking to somebody like Chris gives people a different side, an introspective into, you know, these chefs.
Well, and I think when people do a web search for Chris Cosentino, one of the things we found that's very interesting, by the way, in the last month we've gone over 100,000 of you listen downloading us online. That's cool, by the way.
That's great.
Six digits online and plus the thousands that listen to us here in Central Jersey. One of the things we found is that when people do do Google searches for people who've been on our show, we're usually in the top results that come up, and that's how people find us. One of the things I hope that people do is when people look at Chris Cosentino because he's on The Next Iron Chef, you see how he competed there, and it was a great display of skill. But there's more to him than that, and hopefully I like that we get to flesh that out. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I like that he gets to talk about it. We'll have the winner of Iron Chef on in the next week or so. We'll see who comes out on top, and that should be pretty interesting.
We're down to our final two.
Actually, we'll also have the guy who loses. So everybody, we got two left to go on the Restaurant Guys. So follow them with us. I hope you've enjoyed this hour on the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.